Columbia University Graduate School.
Yes.
Where I was with you.
Yeah.
started on June 1st, 1964.
Uh-huh. And if you've covered the presidential campaign starting with 1968, the Nixon campaign in 1968, and the presidency from a variety of positions around town, both at the White House and from the State Department. So you bring a special perspective to our discussion, because you can see during that time period television has became increasingly important, and yet it also changed in a lot of ways, from being the three networks to now involving so many different stations, and five networks and cable make a big difference. During the time that you've been in Washington, has the role of the press changed?
I don't know if the role of the press has changed. I'd like to think that it remains the same, but mm-hmm. the way in which we cover news has changed enormously, and it's partly because of the technology, mm-hmm. Which has changed so dramatically from when I began working at CBS News almost 40 years ago. And it's partly because of the ubiquitous nature mm-hmm. of information, which is now no longer solely the property of the newspapers and broadcast journalists, mm-hmm. but now is everybody's property. Anybody can publish, as it were, and many do.
Mm-hmm.
To put it in perspective, when I started covering the White House 23 years ago for CBS News, at the beginning of the Reagan administration, there were three television networks, and one of them was still not fully established, ABC. Mm-hmm. So it was really NBC and CBS, and ABC was not yet the key player that it uh-huh. became. And when you had the evening news broadcast at 6:30 Eastern Time, that was the first opportunity that people in the country had to see the latest film footage, remember film?
Mm-hmm.
And of whatever was going on in the country and the world.
Yeah.
We had a little bit of a monopoly on the images and on the resources to bring news from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally, completely changed. The advent of cable news meant that the news was delivered constantly.
So how does the viewer, the listener, the reader sift in that kind of situation and know what is authentic and what isn't?
Well, you can go by the reputation of the news organization mm-hmm. or the individual reporter, or you can follow your own prejudices, and many people do,
mm-hmm.
and decide for yourself what you think is authentic. There is a real sort of anarchy out there.
Mm-hmm.
It is up to you more than ever, as the viewer, as the reader, to decide, you know, what you invest with authority.
Mm-hmm.
And it is all we can offer, those of us who do this for a living and have for a long time, our experience and what we hope is a certain rigor in the presentation of journalism. You can get into a lot of arguments about this, and I hope that we'll have some discussion about it this evening.
Mm-hmm.
Is the fact that I've been covering politics for almost 40 years, does that mean that I have a more incisive view of it than someone who has a take on it from, just for the last couple of years? Maybe not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I may have a better historical memory, but the newcomer's insights may be just as good. And that's nobody any longer can uh-huh. claim a monopoly of information.
But do you notice a change, say, in the briefing room and the kinds of questions that come up? Because now there are instances where rumors that are on the net make their way as questions into the briefing room as a way of, whether the reporter who brings them up may or may not believe them, but they're a way of pushing at the administration, saying, there are stories out there that such and such, and so it becomes an edge that you can use, a tool.
I think what's changed is that the net means that you can bring these unsubstantiated stories to the surface more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They would always eventually make their way to the surface. Now they're immediate. And it's a lever with which, if it appears on the net, you can go in and say, there's an unsubstantiated rumor that the president is having relations with a Martian. I mean, you know, whatever. And then even though they don't like it, they know they're going to have to respond to it. It used to take a lot longer for that stuff to surface, and they used to try any members of any administration to discourage that on the grounds that it wasn't professional. But that's all bets are off these days.
So, but it's still, it would still come up.
Well, sure. I mean, for example, during the Lewinsky business with in the Clinton administration, the press secretary, Mike McCurry, on several occasions had a sort of little fit when asked questions about the president's activities and said, I'm not going to dignify that with an answer. Well, you can only get away with that once or twice.
How has it made a difference to how you do your work? Like, say, for example, when you were putting stories together when you first came into the Reagan administration, and or putting a day's worth of stories together then, and then what you do now, what's the difference in both the number of stories that you do, how long that you're at the White House, and how quickly you get things out on the air?
Well, there's an enormous pressure to get things out quickly. If news, big news is breaking, then we're in the same game as the cable people. We go on the air, we preempt the standard broadcast, and we do the same thing they do. So that's when the pressure is really on to deliver. On a day-to-day basis, the information technology makes it so much easier today than it was 20 or more years ago to gather information. I mean, we used to have at CBS News and the Washington Bureau a research department, which was staffed by a researcher. And I would call up the researcher in Reagan days and say, can you dig out for me what the president said a year ago on this subject? And a couple of hours later, it would, you know, I'd get a call back. And maybe a courier would bring over some printouts from the office. Now, I can do it myself in an instant because we have all of the search technology available to us on our desktops. I can access the wires individually and immediately on my desktop to see what the what they are reporting. It used to be that at the White House, in the press secretary's lower office, I guess it was the upper office, along one wall there was a bank of teletype machines that went clackety-clackety-clack and printed out news on rolls of paper. Sounds like a weird thing, I'm sure, to people under a certain age. And we would gather up there if something was going on and watch the printout as it was rolling out to see what the wires were saying, if, you know, if this was happening somewhere else, in Lebanon, say, or, you know, even elsewhere in the United States. Now it's all at our fingertips. It is much easier. It is much faster. We can access our own material that other people in our organizations gather in the same way.
How long did it take to go live at that time? I know during Johnson's administration, I think it was 6 hours, that it took 6 hours to set up to go live.
By the time I started covering the White House, they had video lines on the North Lawn and in the briefing room. So that, for instance, in March of 1981, when President Reagan was shot, I was not at the hotel. I was at the White House, and we were live almost immediately because we were able to do it.
How do you see, well, let's say your role as a reporter, as a surrogate for the public? Tell us about that. how you see yourself, what your role is, your relationship with the public, and then and what that means for your relationship with government.
Well, my first duty is to report, is to the public, to report what I can observe and to inform with the benefit of my experience mm-hmm. as best I can. You can get into a whole discussion here, and it's a subset of what we're talking about objectivity and fairness. I don't know that there is any such thing as objectivity, but it's certainly possible to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
But put that to one side. I see my job as telling the viewing audience what happened on a given day at the White House. Now, I get only a small amount of time to do this. Few minutes in the morning, few minutes in the evening, and I will generally distill that story down to probably something very much like what the wires are reporting. It's a headline service, basically. Broadcast news is, for the most part, a headline service. There are exceptions. There's Nightline, there's Frontline, mm-hmm. And there is the occasional documentary. But daily journalism in broadcasting is a series of headlines with a little, you know, with a paragraph or two of explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the effort is to distill it into something that makes sense, tells the story. First, you're telling the story, and leaves the viewer with a sense of what happened. Now, when you tell a story, you make choices. Mm-hmm. And that is where we get into these arguments about our biases.
Mm-hmm.
So you try to make choices that fairly represent what happened.
How do you make those choices? I mean, it's not going to be just you. Who do you talk to in your organization? How is that whole process, the whole process of putting together the evening news broadcast and the morning programs as well?
Well, that's a good point, because it isn't just the individual reporter. It is a product of It goes through several people. I work with a producer who, and that title can mean different things in different mm-hmm. Kinds of organizations. In broadcast news, the producer is the reporter's alter ego, who also views the story, but whose primary responsibility is supervising the editing of the story so that the words and the uh-huh. pictures fit together. But the producer is a sort of second head to look at this, a second pair of eyes,
uh-huh.
And the producer will make suggestions about the way the story is written. I write, mm-hmm. although sometimes producers write and send it to me. I look at it, change it, whatever, send it back. So there are two people collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
That then is reviewed for evening or morning by a senior producer here in Washington, and then it's looked at in New York mm-hmm. by the broadcast producers. And it can be changed anywhere in that cycle. I would say that in 90% of the cases, only small changes are made. Sometimes they ask for major changes, and that's usually because they want to fit in a certain graphic or a certain picture.
Uh-huh.
If you write something for the morning news cycle and you you send it in the evening
uh-huh.
and you go in the morning at 6:30, which I will tomorrow. For instance, as we speak here tonight, I have filed a story for tomorrow morning
uh-huh.
which looks ahead to the president's news conference.
Uh-huh.
Tomorrow morning I'll go in at 6:30 before going on the air at 7, and I will look for a message from the producer here or in New York to see if any changes have been made overnight.
Mm-hmm.
If serious changes are wanted, they'll call me at home, and I'll do it before I leave. I have an audio line into my home so that I can
uh-huh.
change it from there.
So what time would you have to do that?
Around 6:30.
Uh-huh.
6:30.
Uh-huh. For the evening broadcast, when does it have to be? When does your story have to be? To be set, the one that you're putting out as the story that you want to do.
You talk about it all day, but you really don't have to write it
mm-hmm.
until about 5:30. But that's on the late side. They would prefer to have it earlier. We have a saying, the earlier they get it, the more they'll change it. And that's often the case.
Do you find that the White House, that the press offices over the years, and I guess communications offices too, kind of free up time for television in the later part of the day, so at around, say, from 4 to 6, that they try to be available for television?
If they're going to return your calls on a given day, and it varies from day to day, that's when they will generally do it, yeah, later in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. What do you find in the various administration that you've been in, that you've covered, as far as how they responded to television, how important television was to them? Has it been uniformly true that television is important to each of the administrations, or has it not been?
Television has become progressively important. I think starting with Ronald Reagan, which is the time I started to cover the White House, that all of the presidents since Reagan understood the power of television and the necessity of using television. But let me go back to this thought. No president whom I have watched or covered really likes the press. We are an annoyance. We get in the way of their message, yet they have to live with us because we also, you know, broadcast their message when we're not getting in the way and trying to decide what it is ourselves. So it's always an uneasy relationship. The press secretary serves the president, but also, you know, tries to work with us to make to make the best translation of the boss's story. There are days when some days it's much harder than others.
Right. In looking at those presidents, one president who seemed not to be particularly bothered by the relationship was Gerald Ford. That Ford was more easygoing about that relationship than most anyone. I don't remember his having gotten particularly upset, although most of the others, and certainly their staffs, have gotten upset.
Well, Ford, of course, was an anomaly,
having
come to the presidency the way he did. He had been in the House. He had been used to being in close touch with reporters and with constituents, and he was not a man of any pretense.
Yeah. And we often hear that Reagan was perhaps the best president in being able to communicate by using television. What made him so good at it?
Well, first of all, he had, you know, 20, 30 years' experience as an actor. He knew how to present himself. He knew how to deliver lines. He understood the value of a pause to make a point.
Yeah.
He had a practiced actor's sense of timing and delivery. But he also, and I think this is equally important, if not more important, he also had a message in which he completely believed. It really helps if you believe to communicate something if you actually really believe it. You know, there's the old saying about, faking sincerity. He didn't have to fake it. That's what he believed. And that's the way it came across. That's very effective. I mean, and in the same way, on a very different plane, when Bill Clinton got into a riff on any program, and he was extraordinarily well informed on policy matters, and he was very good at projecting the fact that he cared about policy, and sometimes very good about caring for people as well, and it came across. There are some things you can't fake, and good politicians often have those qualities and are able to project them.
An example of that, I was thinking of Clinton and his projecting of his knowledge of policy, was a press conference that you probably attended in the State Department where he went on, I think, for about 94 minutes. And
yes, I remember.
His press secretary, Mike McCurry, was giving him signs. He'd say one last question, and Clinton just kept going and going. And you got a sense from it how broad the range was of his knowledge of government policy and of the interests that he had in particular policies. And it was a good example of the kinds of things that you can do with a press conference, the way that you can use that. Reagan, while he sometimes made errors in a fact in his press conferences, that didn't seem to hurt him in the least, that was something that the public accepted by him.
People always seemed willing to cut him a little slack on that.
They did. Who did you think has been particularly good in their press conferences?
Well, I mean, Clinton was good on the facts and good at emoting. Reagan was good at projecting his mm-hmm. message. This president Bush is not particularly effective, I don't think, except that he stays closely on message, and that's mm-hmm. probably a plus because mm-hmm. it means that he's easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
His father was also a bit of a policy wonk. Mm-hmm. And seemed very anxious to display that mm-hmm. following Reagan, who was always somewhat removed and distant.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Nixon was never very good on television.
Uh-huh.
I mean, debate or no debate, I mean, even after he became president, he was awkward and stilted, uh-huh. did not really relate to television. Maybe because he didn't really relate very well to people.
But television was very important to him. If you, in looking at the news summary, when he would receive the news summary, he would write on the side what things he wanted as action items so the message could be communicated by the evening news broadcast. Like I remember seeing one of them that said fire somebody by 3 o'clock because he wanted to make sure that that it made the network news.
Well, that's another thing you bring up. I mean, all White Houses, sooner or later, if they don't start out understanding it, understand that there are benefits to playing the news cycle.
Mm-hmm.
If you want something to generally escape notice, you release it Friday at 6:30 or 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
Nobody reads the Saturday papers. It barely gets on, or if it gets on the Friday evening news, and by Sunday it's kind of gone.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that's what they were going to do with this memorandum from the president's daily briefing of August 6, 2001. They wound up releasing it on Saturday night for the Sunday papers, I guess probably so that it wouldn't get in the way of the news conference and the Mubarak visit, which mm-hmm. were today.
Yeah. I noticed that when they sent out the notification of the conference call, for the background briefing on it, that it was sent out at 5:15 and the conference was at 5:45, the conference call. So you would have had to have been on your computer
I think it didn't actually happen till 6:15 or 6:20.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I wasn't working, but my colleagues who were complained bitterly that they didn't have it in time for the evening news feed.
Oh, I see. There was an article recently in the New Yorker, Ken Oletta's piece called Fortress Bush. At the end of it, the kicker was a quote from Mark McKinnon, who said that the White House press corps was lost in the dust of the internet and cable, and tried to put that idea forward as if it was irrelevant. Do you think that there's a difference of the importance of the White House press corps today, that its mission is any different than it was, say, 50 years ago?
I don't think our mission is any different. I think we probably are less important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, when I started covering the place in 1981, the 2.5 networks mm-hmm. had 92% of the audience mm-hmm. among them at 6:30 on any given evening. And now we have something less than 60 among us. The rest goes to cable and to the net. And, you know, and as I said, people can get their news anywhere. Sure, we are less important, no doubt about it. But has our job function changed? I don't think so. I think we still need to try to do the same thing.
Because actually, the story of what it is the president's doing, what is going on in the White House, that comes from the White House press corps, that newspapers around the country are going to use not just their own story on something, like, say, I remember reading a story on after they put out their energy proposal, and I was in College Station, Texas, and I read it in the local paper there, and the story was by Terry Hunt, who was Associated Press, who was, you know, right down where you are. And it seems that really when it comes right down to it, the reporting of a White House comes from the White House press corps, and that is the first cut of history for an administration. And that's as important in one decade as another.
That's still true, but there was a time when you could only get the material to report if you were there.
Yeah.
That's no longer true. If you are a journalist, you can receive the White House's press releases, which, for example, would include something about that environmental policy or anything else, mm-hmm. on your computer, and you can be in College Station, Texas, and write about it yourself if you mm-hmm. want.
Uh-huh.
Now, you don't have to be there physically anymore to cover the place. I mean, I think you really do, but the information goes out regardless.
What difference do you think that it makes to be there as not just to be in College Station, but to be elsewhere in Washington and to try to cover it, like cover the briefing from the just by watching it on C-SPAN or if it's covered by CNN or Fox, to try to cover the White House in that way rather than being there at the White House? What's the difference?
You get the basic information by watching the video feed, mm-hmm. but you can't then go up and tug on somebody's coattail at the end and say, I'd like to talk to you later about X, or ask them a quick question as they run out of the room saying, what about Y?
Uh-huh.
You can't then go up and camp outside the press secretary's door knowing that he'll have to come out and go to the bathroom at some point so that you can ask him a question.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make small talk with the people in the lower press office to find out when the next trip actually starts or whatever.
Yeah.
There's an enormous advantage in actually physically being there because you're in human contact.
Uh-huh. Right.
You can glean a lot of information
from
the electronic broadcast or from the transcripts, but it's not the same as being there.
Uh-huh. Does it make a difference, do you think, as far as just generally getting responses from White House officials, that those people that they see there continually, that they're going to respond to? I mean, there's some people they're going to respond to no matter what, but I know that there's some people who come because they feel that they just fall off the radar screen if they're not present part of that time.
I think that's right, but you've touched on one of the tenderest issues among reporters, and that is the issue of the pecking order.
Yeah.
The major news media organizations, which is to say the broadcast networks and cable networks,
mm-hmm.
the wire services, Associated Press, Reuters, also Agence France-Presse, and the major newspapers, the mm-hmm. New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times,
Wall Street Journal.
The Wall Street Journal and USA Today, and after that it falls off sharply.
Uh-huh.
Those people will almost always get their calls returned.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're mad at you, then one of your colleagues, because there's usually more than one of you,
mm-hmm.
can get his or her calls returned.
Uh-huh.
But if you work for the Podunk Blade, you may not get your call returned at all, and if they get annoyed at you, you may go for months without a call. And that is a very tender subject, as you know, in the press room.
Yeah.
The big media get most of the attention.
Right. And you can see that, during Ari's briefings, because Ari went around the room starting with, he just went down seat by seat. And I would say that two-thirds of the time was spent on the first in the first three rows. And if you weren't in one of the first three rows, and you know, you were nowhere. And that is the only chance that some of the people in the back of the room get to get a question.
Right.
Now, the way Scott is doing it is to go around by subject. And so people in the back do get an opportunity. Do you think that it's, what do you think in looking at the two ways of doing the briefing, of what you thought was more effective and who benefits by how the questions are asked?
I think it helps everybody. Well, let me back off that. I think it helps most of us to stay on one subject until it's exhausted.
Yeah.
It probably doesn't help the people who cover the White House for specialized publications, Oil Daily, mm-hmm. Aviation Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to talk about, you know, Iraq or about jobs or whatever, it probably doesn't help them. But most of us are served if the news of the day is exhausted
mm-hmm.
And you go around the room and call on people who have questions on that topic.
Uh-huh. One of the things that I don't know that I've seemed to see is that when you go by topic, that reporters work off of each other's questions mm-hmm. more than is true when you just go down the row. So you do get much deeper into the White House response.
Doesn't mean you get any better answers.
Uh-huh.
Which here, let me bring up something else. The daily briefing is useful as a way of letting us know what's on their minds,
mm-hmm.
and of letting them know what's on our minds. But not a lot of useful information actually is exchanged.
Mm-hmm.
You do better afterward by following up with telephone calls to not just the White House press secretary, but to other officials in the government
mm-hmm.
to find out a little bit more about what's going on. There's only a certain amount they want to say in public and on the record every day.
Mm-hmm.
The rest you have to dig out yourself.
William Price, who was a reporter in the late 1800s, did a piece, it was 1902, where the Evening Star, for which he worked, was celebrating its 50th anniversary. And they asked the correspondents who covered particular beats to talk about their beat. And he talked about how rarely is news given at the White House on its own. And he said, you have to be like the miner and dig. And he talked about how you have to go up to the hill and you have to go to the bureaucracy. So in many ways, you know, it hasn't changed. That's always been part of a White House beat.
Yeah, you bet. That's a good example. Because when the White House doesn't want to tell you something, what do you do? Why, you generally call somebody in the opposition party on the Hill.
Uh-huh.
Because they'll almost always be happy to talk. And they'll have, you know, they'll have more information. They're certainly on the staff level. They know what's going on.
Do they call you?
Sometimes.
When Chris Matthews worked for President Carter as a speechwriter and then went up to the Hill and worked for Tip O'Neill, that one of the ways he found that Tip O'Neill didn't get as much airtime or as much ink as he thought that he should, and that they, you know, getting their issues out. So one of the things he would do would be to call people. He also got television people to come and talk to O'Neill when he arrived in the morning. And so the issues that were then raised there would make their way to the briefing. Did you ever get any calls from him, or see that kind of thing working where they were trying to push the administration from a Hill perspective?
Yes, I've gotten calls from people on the Hill,
yeah.
But what Chris started with the speaker is still goes on today. There's a in both houses, there's mm-hmm. generally a little reporter's scrum before the day's business begins in the well of the House or somewhere on the floor of the Senate, where reporters can ask the speaker or the majority leader, you know, what's going on that particular day, and that helps them to set the agenda a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't guarantee that will be the agenda, but it's another attempt at agenda setting. The White House does its agenda setting with two daily briefings. So the Hill people figured out that you can do that from the Hill as well if you're in the leadership. But what upsets them all is that the press sometimes sets the agenda itself if it decides that X is news and not Y, which they want to talk about.
Have you noticed, well, of course, the White House starts out with its meetings very early in the day. So it does the agenda setting in a way for the day, and then the Congress has to respond to it. But one of the things that's probably, it's changed during the time that you've been in Washington, are the number of interest groups that are there and the degree to which they're very sophisticated in communications techniques. And in a way, you know, you have graduates of White House communications operations who then, once their administration leaves, those people then are on the outside knowing very well how things work on the inside and what the rhythms are inside a White House. And have you noticed that, how over time that that there are just many more people that have a sense of how a White House works and how communications work so that they can affect their story?
Not all of the people in any given White House wait until that president's term is up before they go to work in communications, and there's a lot of it. Most of them wind up in the communications or lobbying, and either way they're trying to influence the agenda. The lobbyists talk mainly to the Hill, but we often talk to the lobbyists, particularly if they have run campaigns in the past, and a lot of them have. We talk to the people who are in the public relations business perhaps a little less often, because most of them do not have clients frequently. They do sometimes, who have business with the White House.
You've covered campaigns and you've covered governing. What are the difference in the rhythms of how those two work? The kinds of people that are there, the way the story is shaped, and how long a story is, in the sense that, you know, in campaigns things seem to move on, like on a daily cycle.
In a campaign, you're always looking, and no matter how many seminars reporters attend, they all wind up doing horse race pieces in campaigns. We all hear about how, you know, we really need to talk about the issues, but the minute you start talking about issues, people start to nod off. Doesn't, and I'm not saying that shouldn't be done, but most of the campaign coverage on a day-to-day basis is who's up, who's down, what happened to the opponent, what do you, the candidate, have to say about that. It tends to be very superficial. There's always an effort by major newspapers and by major broadcast organizations during any presidential campaign to say, right, here's our look at the issues. And it's a good thing. But not much attention really gets paid.
How did you like covering campaigns as opposed to covering a White House?
Oh, covering a campaign is much more fun. I mean, you're making it up as you go along. There's a certain camaraderie when you're on the bus, you're on the plane. There's a danger of becoming too close to the candidate and the candidate's people. I will never forget having covered Clinton's campaign, how in the first week of the Clinton administration, a person in the press office who had been on the campaign and who I had known came up to me and said, "I can't believe you said that about the president." Just, you know, overwrought. I said, "Well, you know, get a life. Hello. It's the way it is." You know. He thought of me, I guess, as an ally.
Do you find that's something that happens between the two parties, that Democrats tend to think of reporters as their friends, and establish relationships that they try to get the president together with reporters, thinking, you know, if they only knew the president, that the stories would be better. That Republicans tend not to do that. The Republicans never think that they're going to, the reporters are going to be their friend, and instead what they want to do is just get them to report the way that they want, talk about what they want to talk about.
I think in broad brush, that's true. But I do remember that Richard Nixon had several off-the-record briefings with reporters.
Mm-hmm.
I remember asking him what he would do about China. Little did I know.
Yeah.
He, of course, at the time didn't answer it.
Uh-huh.
After Ronald Reagan became president, his handlers had reporters in for several sessions of cocktails and so mm-hmm. forth. And those, typically, when that happens with any president, it's off the record.
Mm-hmm.
But 99% of what the president says in those off-the-record sessions is exactly what the president says when he speaks in public.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly true with the Reagan sessions.
Uh-huh.
President Bush had one, about 6 weeks ago, mm-hmm. as we speak. He does it rarely, but he did it about 6 weeks ago. And 90% of what he said off the record was what he had said on the record in public about Iraq, about the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, but it isn't always.
Uh-huh.
In any case, I think your general point is right. Democrats tend to view the press as uh-huh. friendly, which I think you will find is less and less the case. There mm-hmm. are a lot of people now coming into the business are not automatically sort of liberal, as was the case,
right.
but many more are conservative than were before.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to see how it developed. It changes constantly,
mm-hmm.
and it's I find it very strange that nobody seems to be able to anticipate change when it's a constant.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people are always taken aback when mm-hmm. things change, politicians particularly. And change, as Bill Clinton once said, is your friend, particularly mm-hmm. if you're a reporter.
Uh-huh. Well, for White Houses, changes in technology have seemed to really be something that they've taken advantage of, that the successful administrations have looked forward to it. So, for example, they've never looked at dealing with news organizations or with reporters as feeding the beast. A successful administration looks at the opportunity that there is to try to shape stories and to get the kinds of ideas and viewpoints that the president wants out, that they make sure and make use of technology. But not all administrations have been able to do it.
Generally, any White House will try to have a message every day.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, this isn't a typical time because of the war in Iraq and because of the various controversies that are swirling about. But most of the time, whatever the White House's agenda is gets put aside by whatever is considered the news of the day.
Mm-hmm.
It would be as though if right now the president tried to talk about jobs, which he has tried to do, it gets largely ignored because the news is about Iraq
mm-hmm.
and about what happened in the wake of the 9/11 briefings and so forth.
Yeah.
And the 9/11 Commission is holding hearings as we speak.
Do you find that Republican press secretaries and press offices are sometimes less informed than is true in a Democratic administration? A Democratic administration tends to be more focused on the daily operation, getting out the daily news, and so they will put people in there who are tied in with the president, whether it's a Jody Powell or a Mike McCurry or a Joe Lockhart, that are they're going directly to the president rather than somebody who has to go through the communications director. One of the things I was thinking about was the was Grenada and the story that that you worked on about U.S. troops going into Grenada. Can you tell us about that and about the White House response, the press office response?
It was, 1982, I think, early 80s. We began to get reports from various people in the Caribbean that there was a U.S. force headed for Grenada. And I went up with Terry Hunt. I grabbed Hunt and took him with me so I'd have a witness.
Mm-hmm.
And I waited outside Larry Speaks' door. He was then the press spokesman. And I said, when he finally appeared, I think, for a bathroom break. You know, what about the troops heading for Grenada? Are we going to invade Grenada? Now, it was all over the radio down there. The troop movement, the ship movements had been observed. It wasn't much of a secret. Speaks had no idea. He called John Poindexter, who was the deputy national security advisor, and came back out and said, quoting Poindexter, "Knock it down hard, no invasion of Grenada." Of course, it happened the next morning.
Yeah.
The next morning, we were all in early because there was something else going on. Maybe one of the hostage crises with TWA 847, or was it the Marine
Lebanon?
Barracks?
Yeah, I think it was the Marine Barracks. Yeah.
And we were all in early anyway.
Uh-huh.
And when I came through the gate at the White House at 6-something in the morning, I heard one Secret Service guard say to the other, "The Prime Minister of Dominica is at the gate." I thought, Caribbean, you know, nation.
Yeah. What consequences are there in that kind of situation for a press secretary if they don't give reporters the correct information?
Well, I mean, if you don't have the information and you and you can't give it, then you're seen as out of the loop.
Mm-hmm.
If you do have the information and don't give it, then you're seen as covering up, depending on what the information is that you're not giving.
Mm-hmm.
Now, any administration would make an argument that you can't admit that there's an invasion force on the way before the invasion happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's something to that as an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And yet what was going on was not secret to the Grenadians and the Cubans, only to the American public, which is frequently the case with a lot of secret stuff.
In looking at your time in Washington, which presidents do you think have been most effective in being able to deal with the press, not just television, but using the press in a way that is focused their message and has focused public attention at times that worked out well for them?
Well, I wasn't here when Lyndon Johnson was president. I was working overseas and in the Midwest. But Johnson had a very effective old style of press relationship. He would collar an individual reporter, and he would give that reporter, usually a print person, but sometimes broadcast, a story.
Mm-hmm.
And he would do it either to screw another reporter or somebody on the Hill. I mean, he, with Johnson, it was all personal. And, I mean, nobody else since then has ever done it that way. Beginning with Nixon, all the presidencies except for perhaps Gerald Ford's have attempted to use television and use the media in a sort of more modern way.
Mm-hmm.
Favored reporters can still sometimes get scoops, but it's far rarer than it used to be.
Uh-huh. Frank Cormier, who was a wire reporter, talked about one day of thinking about Johnson and looking at the wires, because he had them in his office. And so he used to read them when they came out, too. But he used to kneel down. People would see him kneel down and looking at it as it was being printed. And so he came back to Cormier to tell him that he had his report was not correct. So he did focus very heavily on his coverage, on coverage of himself. Okay, let's go to some questions. And let's, Towson?
I have a question about how you deal with the new 24-hour news cycle, because other people who come to the class, they've said that the news doesn't always happen as fast as media would like to. So what do you find yourself doing on a slow news day or when there's not a big story to focus on?
Interesting question, because you see what happens on a slow news day on the cable networks. They keep repeating what they have over and over and over again. If there's not much going on, we try to dig and find something that is going on. It's particularly on those slow days when you're not being driven by events that you go and look to see what you can develop or enlarge or get started. Not always an easy process. That's always the hardest part. When things are happening, you react to them. But when things are not happening, in order to make news, you have to go find it. It's considerably more difficult. You know, there's an endless echo chamber with the 24/7 news coverage. And even for us who are in the middle of it, it gets really old. And you turn the sound off.
Okay, in California, does anybody have a question?
Yes, sir.
How would you like to see
news coverage? I've got a mic for you.
How would you like to see news coverage change from what it's like now? I know CBS doesn't have a cable network or anything like that. So would you like more time to discuss issues or something like that? Or?
I wish it were possible in the commercial broadcasting world to have a program that was more like the NewsHour or another Nightline, because that would give journalists an opportunity to explore things in greater depth. As a practical fact, it isn't likely to happen because commercial broadcasting is just that. It's commercial. The bottom line is that it makes its ideas to make money. And we're always going to be limited in resources and in time. In a perfect world, I would like to have more time, and I would hope that we could persuade people to listen. But look, if you look at the audience for serious journalism, it's very small. The number of people who watch the NewsHour, the number of people who watch Nightline are far, far fewer than the larger audiences for the even for the cable networks.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about that you talked about earlier, the off-the-record sessions with the president, even if what the president says is the same as what he would say in an open session, he still has a luxury of feeling that much more relaxed. What do you learn about a president in off-the-record sessions?
It's a good question, Martha. You watch any person's body language, mm-hmm. and it's like sitting down with a few people, perhaps one that you don't know so well, and talking for a couple mm-hmm. of hours mm-hmm. or an hour, whatever, in a relaxed atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody out there can relate to this. You form opinions about mm-hmm. the people, particularly mm-hmm. the ones you don't know. And you get a vibe for what you think that person is like because you're up close and you're listening. Mm-hmm. And if you have a real exchange of views, a conversation as opposed to a monologue, which with politicians it's often a monologue, but if it's uh-huh. a real conversation, yeah. then you can watch and see how a person reacts mm-hmm. to questions, mm-hmm. To something that might be, mildly off-putting or embarrassing or mm-hmm. perhaps difficult,
mm-hmm.
and you come away feeling that you have a better sense of the individual.
Mm-hmm. And I suspect there are priorities, because even if he's saying, say, the same thing that he might say in a public setting, you might think, well, his staff has gone through and have looked at the focus groups, polls, and that these are the things that they should be focusing on. But you get more of a sense of the president's, perhaps of his priorities and how he responds to things.
So, you can tell right away whether you're getting a canned answer.
Uh-huh.
If you're in a casual conversation, if you've heard it before, mm-hmm. or it comes out too neatly packaged, you'll suspect that it's something he's gone over and rehearsed. But if you're getting something that's really thoughtful, mm-hmm. you're bound to be more intrigued.
Were there many off-the-record sessions when you first came to Washington? There were more of them than there currently are.
Not sure that that's the case. There have always been too many in one sense. People would rather go off the record or on background than be quoted publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And many news organizations like the AP have a policy of no blind quotes.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the AP allows it if the subject insists.
Mm-hmm.
But the only, if you are quoting an administration official, the only assurance that the reader or the viewer or the listener has that you are, you know, actually repeating something that someone said to you mm-hmm. is your own reputation. Mm-hmm. Because you could be making it up.
Do you find, though, in the current atmosphere after, say, Jason Blair at the New York Times and Kelly at USA Today, that there's more interest in all organizations internally of finding out who the sources are, that they're more likely to ask you who a source is?
I think that's probably right. If it isn't, it should be. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things like those incidents that you mentioned result in more lip service being paid, mm-hmm. But in fact, they should serve as wake-up calls.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that I had for you before I go back to another question. We met years ago in a class on the presidency that was taught by Richard Neustadt. And what difference did it make taking a course on the presidency, and you also took American history with Bill Lochtenberg? What did that bring to your reporting when you came to the White House?
I think it probably informed it in a way that if I had just come off of reporting without benefit of that class, it made it much richer for me. Mm-hmm. To be able to read as widely as we were able to read in that year and for that class, mm-hmm. and to appreciate history from the perspective of somebody like Lochtenberg, who'd done so much right. research into the materials of the time and presented it so well, mm-hmm. Really gave you a perspective. Mm-hmm. And I hope that because I've been doing this for a long time, I can give a little perspective occasionally, too. Mm-hmm. It helps you to come at these things knowing what went before. Mm-hmm. If you approach everything as though it is the first time it's ever happened in the civilized world mm-hmm. and in recorded history, then you're missing all of the rich context.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So in a way, there are a lot of things that, for example, they're just the rhythms that repeat themselves throughout sure. administrations. And it gives you much more of a sense, perhaps, of an institutional character of the relationship between the White House and the press, but the kinds of things that happen from one administration to another that can be anticipated. But most reporters, when they come to the White House, don't have that kind of background and don't do much reading in either the presidency or in American history.
Then you cover it on a day-to-day basis, and that's fine. Uh-huh. But it's not as to me. It's you don't mm-hmm. get as much context out of it.
Yeah, in covering it for television, do you get to go beyond just looking at the president and getting into the White House and how a White House works? It doesn't seem to be a very visual story. How do you do that for television?
It's not a very visual story, and usually you wind up using a lot of what we call in the business wallpaper, uh-huh. which is pictures to illustrate or to run behind graphics. Mm-hmm. If you're starting to talk about the problems that the president is having with Iraq, it'll be pictures of, you know, soldiers in Iraq. And there are a lot of graphics, mm-hmm. Some of them very good. I mean, our graphics have gotten better and better over the years, probably because people are doing lots of new and different things, and that's influenced by the net as well. Mm-hmm. And graphics are a very important tool in television, mm-hmm. Not only for just listing things, but for demonstrating through pictures and drawings what you're trying to say.
Yeah, but one example of that comes to mind is the interview that Tim Russert did, his Meet the Press interview. With President Bush, and he used a graphic there on
right.
the economy, and that was, I thought, a particular powerful graphic. Yeah. Towson, a question.
Given the 24-hour news service, the cable networks, the huge followings that Fox News, CNN, and the other cable news services have, do you think that the nightly news with CBS, NBC, and ABC could possibly be canceled one day?
Could possibly be?
What was the end of your question?
Given the 24-hour news service, do you think that the nightly news, every single night, the 30-minute news spot for CBS, NBC, and ABC, do you think it could possibly be canceled one day given the huge following that cable news services have?
Right, I've got you. Well, first of all, let me correct a slight misimpression. On a given day, the three cable news networks may have collectively not quite 3 million viewers on an important news day, less on most news days. 500,000 is usually the peak on an average day. On any given night, any of the network news broadcasts will still have, despite our decline, about 6 or 7 million viewers. So we still reach a lot more people than they do. But they are very influential because they serve as a sort of jungle telegraph. The cable news operations are on in every office on Capitol Hill, in every foreign ministry around the world. That is how news is communicated these days. But we have more of the actual public. Now, to get to the final point of your question, will the three network news broadcasts survive? I'm not sure they all will. I don't know when the end will come, but it may. It may be that particularly for those networks which have cable, which would be NBC and Fox, that they can put their news on cable. But if you're going to have a news division, you amortize the cost of the news division by putting it on as many programs as you can, morning and evening and weekend. So as long as that continues and as long as it can still sell some commercial time, it will probably survive. Remember that the audience is still pretty big compared to cable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you all have any? Okay, let's go back to Towson.
Your statement earlier about journalists, or at least the media, being less liberal over time, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that, particularly given recent books such as Bloomberg's Bias, which was particularly about CBS, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that. Is it just an impression, or do you have a systematic sense of the newer people coming into the profession are either more conservative or less liberal, at least?
It's only an impression. It's not based on any hard numbers. But I see people now who come as interns or into entry-level jobs who are not necessarily all of a liberal mindset. one of the problems that Goldberg cites in Bias is that a lot of the people he worked with on the East Coast came out of the same sort of middle-class or upper-middle-class milieu and went to many of the same universities, mm-hmm. and tend to have a common outlook on life, which is perhaps, you could say, biased. They don't represent everybody, but a lot of them are working in this business. I think that that is beginning to change, and it's based only on what I see, because I think, and I don't know, you people are closer to it than I am, I think there is a greater diversity of views, and I think there are more conservatives now at the college level than there were in the last 20 years or so. You may not think that's the case, but I mean, I have seen some of it.
Sure.
In the people that come to work for us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the thing is, everybody is going to have a set of biases, if you will, but it's having the experience and the intelligence not to let those rule when you're trying to explain what is happening.
What do you think of this as a bias, rather than having it be whether somebody's liberal or conservative, that those who are at the White House, covering a White House, have a bias in favor of the importance of the story that they're doing? that whatever they're working on, they would think is going to be a crucial story, and that they might try to make more out of it because they see what happens at the White House is so important. So that's a bias of it of itself.
Yes, I think there's a bias in favor of the story you're covering, whatever it is, when you go to your editor and you say, this is why I should have 2 minutes tonight on the evening news, because this is important. There's also a bias against authority, which is very evident in journalism, which is one reason, again, that people who are truly conservative politically find the media so contentious, because the media is generally against authority, particularly the more outlandish exercises of authority. Reporters tend to be contrarians as much as anything else. So that bias exists as well.
Can you give some examples of that?
I should be able to, but I'm not coming up with anything right off the top of my head.
We can think about them. But I've just noticed over the years, as far as bias and talking to people, it's never seemed to me to make any difference whether they were liberal or conservative as far as their reporting was concerned when they were a White House reporter. So, for example, that Britt Hume as a commentator is clearly a conservative.
Right.
But when he was a White House reporter, he was focused on what was going on and what the issues were of the day, and you didn't really see his political views.
No, but if you were of a mind to believe that he was too conservative, then you could probably find fault with the way he presented, with the way he wrote, with the way he presented his stories and the way he acted. Conversely, if you were of a conservative bent, you could probably look at what Sam Donaldson did on the weekends when he was often taking the liberal point of view on the ABC David Brinkley program. And then you could look at what he did during the week at the White House and say, aha, it's a liberal. But you would not necessarily be right, but your own bias would determine how you felt about the reporting.
Well, now he would be an example of a contrarian.
Yeah.
And would always try to shove on stories and shove people as far as he could in order to get them to say something. I can remember that in the briefing room. He would always press the briefer in sharp ways to try to get something out of them that way.
And that's a very useful tactic.
What are the advantages of the White House beat for reporters? I mean, it's a beat where you can't move very far. You can't you see the president only when they want to bring him out, and the area that you can cover is not very great as far as physically is concerned. It's a restricted space, so it's difficult to cover as opposed to the Hill.
Yeah, but there are several very apparent advantages. One is that you're on, if you're a broadcaster, you're on the air all the time. You're on the air every day. If you do radio, you're on the air almost every day if you do television. And because organizations pay attention to how often their reporters appear, this is important. It's also satisfying because you're doing the kind of work you like to do. There's another advantage to covering the White House. You get to see important and interesting events and go to a lot of different places covering a president. The downside is that if you stick around too long, you can get a little bit cynical because you watch patterns repeat themselves. You have to fight not to be cynical. Term limits are probably a good idea, but not for broadcasters because, you know, who wants to give this
right,
up?
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of major newspapers rotate their reporters every couple of years.
How do you keep fresh?
Well, you have to, I think you have to work at sampling the rest of the culture outside the White House, the political culture and the general culture. You can't just have tunnel vision and just look at the White House as all that you do. we have to read a lot of newspapers, and you have to pay attention to what else is going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. And then,
it wouldn't be a bad idea to watch Entertainment Tonight.
Uh-huh. There also are advantages.
Or Saturday Night Live, which had this great skit with, Janet Jackson playing Condi Rice.
Yeah. There's another advantage for some reporters who are interested in using the White House beat as a place to pivot off to some other job, whether it's, say, for print reporters, maybe becoming editors, and then for television becoming anchors.
It is and has been a stepping stone, absolutely, because it's the most visible beat, particularly in broadcasting.
Mm-hmm.
And it remains a stepping stone.
Mm-hmm. Another question? Towson? Okay, well, I'm going to ask one while you all come up with one. What difference does it make to you who's press secretary? What do you need out of a press secretary? What difference does it make?
You need access. It does make a difference. You need access. You need somebody who will engage in the briefing room so that you can get so that you can at least get something on the record.
Mm-hmm.
You need someone to whom you can go when you're not on camera, mm-hmm. and say, so give me a little more about this,
mm-hmm.
and hope that you'll get something that he wasn't or she wasn't willing to say on camera.
Uh-huh. Do they become in
somebody who will play, in other words.
Uh-huh.
But you got to remember, they they work for the president. They don't really mm-hmm. work for us.
But it's in their interest to provide information, because that way you're going to
that's exactly right.
Satisfy news organizations. So in many ways it works together. But in a sense, one of the roles that you need of a press secretary is somebody that can be a good advocate, that can talk to people within a White House, not just the president, but another constituent. You could say that he or she has three constituents, the president, who's the boss, and then White House staff, as well as reporters, because sometimes White House staff don't want to talk, and so a press secretary has to deal with them as well.
A press secretary should be able to go to the chief of staff and say, I think it'd be nice if you had a little sit down with the the network reporters this week,
mm-hmm.
instead of just the wire services. Just the news magazines.
Uh-huh.
To take an example.
Uh-huh. who have you? You've seen a lot of press secretaries. Tell us some of the people that you thought have been effective in the job, and what qualities they had that made them effective.
Mike McCurry was very effective because he had a wide-ranging knowledge of foreign affairs as well as domestic politics.
Mm-hmm.
He was an effective advocate for reporters to the White House, and he was very good at explaining the White House to us.
Mm-hmm.
He also tended to make sense when he was when he was delivering his daily feed from the podium. It was it was not as canned as mm-hmm. as some others.
Uh-huh.
the present press secretary is monotonous in person at the lectern,
mm-hmm.
but is very helpful mm-hmm. On behind the scenes.
Uh-huh.
That was the case for others as well. We've had a lot of people who've come and gone in that job, and George Stephanopoulos, though he didn't have the title, and Dee Dee Myers,
uh-huh.
all of whom were helpful in some ways, but McCurry is probably the standout in my time there.
Mm-hmm. One of the jobs, too, it would seem, of a press secretary is simply bringing information out. And so in some ways, it's not just all hinging on the briefing, that if a press secretary can bring other people out and provide experts from within the White House, that's helpful to reporters. So one of the things that McCurry was able to do and did on a regular basis was bring out the policy people to explain what was going on. Gene Sperling talking about economic issues. And before the China trip, he brought some scholars in to talk about
China. That goes to the point you made earlier about being an advocate for the press inside the White House and doing things which advance the administration's position, but which are also helpful to reporters.
What do you think the reluctance in doing that is? Because two examples that I can think of, somewhat recently, of bringing people out that I thought were effective. Robert Zoellick came out and talked about trade issues and was particularly good. And then you end up with the White House ends up with what are favorable stories going into some depth about the trade policy. William Donaldson and Larry Thompson, William Donaldson, who was the head of the SEC, and then Larry Thompson, who was then at the Justice Department, came over and talked about issues relating to the SEC. And again, it was something that got on television and got good publicity. Why wouldn't a White House do that all the time?
Too often, they're not as interested in dealing with all of the reporters who cover the place. They will deal with the economics reporter for the Times or somebody from the Wall Street Journal, but they're not as concerned about getting the message out widely. Mm-hmm. They narrow cast, as it were, to what they consider their important constituencies, and it's helpful to everybody if they try to make it a little bit broader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this administration seems particularly interested in targeting their audiences. Towson?
How was President Bush in private interviews as opposed to his public news conferences?
He's very laid back and casual. Actually, he comes across that way in his news conferences, too, except that he has a tendency to sort of fall back in public on the same things, the same lines over and over again. He's a little less like that in private, although he will, again, dredge up some of the same things when he's talking about a subject like Iraq, for example. I mean, if you ask him about weapons of mass destruction, you're going to get the same answer in public and in private. But he's a little more relaxed. He still has that sort of jocular attitude that you see on television. He's not a great deal different than he appears on TV.
What about his father? What were the differences between his press conferences and his sessions that would be off-the-record sessions?
Well, his father in public had a... demonstrated and was happy to demonstrate a far greater command of policy. He could talk, he was wonkish about it, like Clinton. In private, his father is extraordinarily gracious and is a good storyteller. Has a certain social ease that his son doesn't pretend to have, perhaps because of the differences in the way they were raised. I mean, the son is very happily a product of Midland, Texas. I mean, sure, he's from this blue blood family and went to school, you know, at private schools in the East, but he did grow up in Midland, and that helps him define who he is. And, of course, his father, for all the pork rind chewing, is still, you know, very much from Connecticut.
What about Reagan? Well, Reagan was pretty much the same. In off the record and
yeah, he really was. He really was. He had a certain reserve with most people. There were very few people who really knew him well, and he was the same with us in private as he was in public.
He seemed to like reporters.
Yeah, Reagan liked most everybody. I mean, you know, he got along. He got along with everyone.
Because at the end, didn't he take reporters back when he went back to California on the plane?
Yeah, I was on that trip.
What was that trip like?
Oh, he was, you know, he didn't seem sad to be leaving. He seemed actually glad to be getting home. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the staff were very emotional on that trip back. Mm-hmm. But he was delighted. Mm-hmm. You see, that's the thing. He didn't miss Washington mm-hmm. after he left. Mm-hmm. He didn't miss being at the peak of power, I don't think. He was extraordinarily secure in himself mm-hmm. for a politician. Uh-huh. You don't usually expect it in politicians. Mm-hmm. You expect politicians to be hungering for public adulation. That wasn't so with him. He didn't need it. One of his most charming qualities, uh-huh. by the way.
And when he came to Washington, he came in a different way than, say, Carter did. When Carter came to Washington, he didn't have this same kind of interest in building a network of relationships with people who are running the town and the political community, which Reagan, when he came into town, he came in with ease and, you know, had the party for Tip O'Neill and others to let everybody know that that he wanted to work together with people. So he had an ease whether he was coming or going. What do you know of the period when presidents leave office, of what it's like for them the first year? Have you dealt with people after they've left office?
Not enough. That's an interesting topic, isn't it? Not really enough to know.
It's usually pretty hard.
I think it's very hard for most of them. I don't think it was very hard for Reagan. Uh-huh. I mean, he was certainly aware of what was going on for a year or two after he left. Uh-huh. I wonder about Bush Sr. Mm-hmm. I think it must be very hard for Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. who is still in the limelight and is likely to remain in the limelight. Uh-huh. Not only because of what he's doing, but because of what Senator Clinton is doing. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
But Clinton made no bones about it. He would have run for a third term if he could have.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever hear from people after they've left, the president, the family?
I hear from staff members, uh-huh. but not generally from the principals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And many of them recycle themselves at Washington.
Uh-huh. Well, they certainly seem to, and especially, too, if there's a second term that you have people leave so they can stay in town.
And make money.
Yeah. Any other questions there?
Anything that I touched on that you would like to know more about, that you would like to challenge me on, or...
Actually, I'd like to ask a follow-up. Jason Blair was mentioned earlier, and I was wondering if you...
What was mentioned? Sorry?
Jason Blair.
Jason Blair, right.
I was wondering if that scandal affected CBS at all in terms of its policies, its fact-checking, and so forth, and whether you might talk a little bit about how it affected the media in general, especially in public perception after that scandal?
Well, it was a real shock, I think, particularly because it was the New York Times that was involved. Mm-hmm. It's a little harder to fake it in television. We do have standards that are fairly rigorously applied. There are people in New York who watch over them all of the time about how you edit and about how you reference people, how you identify them. But you can't really make something up the way he did in television. And the notion that it could happen at the New York Times, I think, was a stunner for a lot of people. It isn't, of course, the first time that sort of thing has happened. There was a case at the Washington Post, I guess 20 years ago now, a woman named Janet Cook wrote about a 7-year-old heroin addict who didn't exist. She won a Pulitzer Prize. Mm-hmm. Before they found out that the child didn't exist. The temptation to come up with a wonderful story, I guess, is often just too strong. I guess In Blair's case, there appear to have been other personal considerations. It certainly caused a reexamination of things at the Times. It was duly noted, I think, by everybody else. And it isn't the only one. There have been a couple of, there was, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. there was the case of Jack Kelly at USA Today, who also, although he didn't sit at home and write the stories, he went to the places that he was covering and made up the stories. It's too bad. It's partly reflective of the pressure to produce, and of the ego. I think people want to be first. Mm-hmm. They want to be good.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in Kelly's case, be right at the center when something spectacular happens.
Right.
Except in all of them, there were a lot of warnings. There are people that had raised issues before in Janet Cook's
case.
And
that's a very good point, because there's a general reluctance in most fields, whether it's news or anything else that you may get into. There's a general reluctance to blow the whistle on colleagues, mm-hmm. because you're never sure whether you're right or wrong. You're never sure whether you're doing the organization a favor or a disservice. It's a very difficult thing, and apparently that was the case in all of these places where, as you say, there were ample warnings.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that seemed different in the Jason Blair case is that that with the Internet, people who worked for the Times were able to write somewhat anonymously about
right.
their feelings. And so there was a particular website, Romanesco, mm-hmm. you know, as part of the Poynter Institute site, where you could read all of the things that different people in the Times were saying.
Right.
And I wonder if that didn't end up helping develop some kind of consensus within the Times.
I think it did. I mean, those anonymous emails were what sort of really mm-hmm. tipped the point on this.
Uh-huh.
And I think something similar happened at USA Today.
Uh-huh. One last question I'd like to ask you, and that's about press conferences, and the president's having a press conference tomorrow. How are you going to determine what question you will ask if you're there, and what process you go through in order to develop your questions?
Well, as it happens, I won't be at tomorrow's. It's not my part of the rotation.
Uh-huh.
I'm not in the rotation for tomorrow, but I will be watching it to prepare a piece for Wednesday morning. I'll be sitting back, and I could go, I guess, but I won't get a question because it'll go to my colleague whose turn it is. But here's what you do. You prepare a list of topics on all the major questions of the day. I mean, uh-huh. certainly Iraq, the presidential daily briefing, the economy, all of these things, the campaign in general. And you have to make a list because you don't know in what order you're going to get called on. Many people, when they watch news conferences, assume that the president has a copy of our question and that we know in what order we're going to be called on.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true in either case. On the other hand, any president's staff can prepare the president, and they do, for questions mm-hmm. that they're likely to get. I mean, it is not a secret what reporters are generally interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Mike Deaver, who worked for Ronald Reagan, once said to me after a news conference, "We predicted every question that you guys were going to ask, except for that one at the end by Sarah McClendon, who was an elderly woman who wrote for a series of newspapers in Texas and who always had something off the wall." I mean, I think she asked about fraud at an Army depot in San Antonio.
Uh-huh.
And they weren't prepared for that one, but they were prepared for all the rest of them. And by the way, White House staff loves to put a president through the drill
mm-hmm.
of a practice press conference because they get to ask the edgy question.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to do about Iraq? But you have to be ready because you don't know who's going to be called on. You don't know which topics will be covered. So you need to be ready with a list and fast on your feet in case you get called on.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of that.
One of the suppositions is that a president has a script. The you know, President Bush in his last nighttime East Room press conference said, mentioned
following
his
script.
But what in fact he was doing is that that they all have layouts of the press conference.
Right. They have a seating chart.
Right.
The White House press staff comes around before each news conference. They've been pretty rare in this administration, but I remember it happening. They come around and they say who is going to be in the front row seat for CBS. Mm-hmm. And you tell them who, and it'll be John Roberts, my colleague, tomorrow night. And and they put that on a chart that goes on the lectern, mm-hmm. and the president can look down and see who's where.
Mm-hmm.
They did this for Ronald Reagan, and I think it was the Scripps Howard guy couldn't make it, so he sent a colleague, and the president looked down and he said, Bob? And the guy in the seat was not named Bob. I mean...
okay. Any others? Okay.
Just one more. What is your favorite moment of being White House press secretary that you can remember?
Well, I was never the press secretary, but you mean being...
I'm sorry. Of being a White House correspondent, I apologize.
You know, that's a good one. You would think that I would have a ready answer. I don't. But there have been a lot of interesting and touching moments. Being at Normandy, for example, in France, where the American cemetery is for the 50th anniversary when Reagan was president, and the 40th anniversary when Reagan was president, and 50th anniversary when Clinton was president. The 60th, incidentally, is mm-hmm. coming up in June. Those connections to history. Being in the Rose Garden. When Sharon and, I mean, Arafat
Rabin,
thanks, yeah. Memory fades, shook hands in what looked like it could be the beginning of a peace deal in the Middle East. How long ago was that? But those are very special moments, and those are things you remember and feel privileged to have been a part of, to have had the front row seat at. And it's one reason why I still love the job, mm-hmm. after all this time.
Yeah.